For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, how did Julius Erving become the Doctor? All right, welcome back to Over and Back. I am Jason, and my very special guest today, Rainus Lattice. He is the host of the Handle podcast, and you also may know him from Twitter and YouTube as Lamar Matic. Rainus, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thanks for having me on, Jason. I'm very excited about doing this, and I appreciate the invite. I've been following the series myself, and you guys have done a great job at discussing an era of pro basketball, which seriously lacks good content. So, yeah, it's great to be on.
Well, I very much appreciate that, and it's been rewarding work. It's been a lot of work to do the research and to get it going, but I've learned a lot about the league that I didn't know before, and it's been nice to share it with other people. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from people who have been into the series, so we're very glad to do it. Today we're going to talk about the early career of Julius Erving, his years in the ABA with the Virginia Squires and the New York Nets, talking about how his legend was built and how he, as the title of the show indicates, how he became the Doctor. Just going a little bit through his overall ABA career, he won two MVPs and shared a third MVP in five seasons. He had two playoff MVPs during that time. He won two championships, had three scoring titles, was on the all-ABA team all five seasons, the four times on the first team, and also had a defensive all-NBA appearance. He was really almost the perfect example of individual artistry blended with the team game to me. He just had so much class, so much grace, almost a regal presence, yet he was a tireless competitor and capable of some of the funkiest and most creative and thrilling moves in basketball history. And even though he tried to leave the ABA after his first season, he really ended up being one of the strongest advocates for the league as it developed and as it became clear that it was going to be merging with the NBA, wanting to take care of other players, really cared about keeping the league alive as long as possible and getting all the players, or as many as he could, get them jobs and have the ABA have a good situation once it was merging with the ABA. And honestly, he really was the lifeblood of the ABA, the most important part of the history of that league.
Yeah, and even though there are guys with great resumes like Roger Brown or perhaps Artis Gilmore, That all of the stuff you said, he pretty much carried the league through its latter years, and he's Mr. ABA, and he's the reason why, according to some people, he's the reason why the NBA just had to eventually reach a merger and take on these ABA franchises, at least four of them.
Yeah, and it's interesting, of course, that he did not have. There was very little television coverage of the ABA during his years there, yet he managed to develop this level of fame, and he had these endorsements and had a national profile despite not very few fans being able to see him on at least national television. It's hard to think of a lot of precedent for that. I mean, obviously the television landscape was very different in sports in the 70s, but most of the other players that would reach a star level would have had some level of, people would have been able to see them, but Erving was very unique in the way where he almost became a great folk hero because you couldn't see him. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, it's almost as a tragedy because when we look back at some of the guys from the 60s from the NBA, I mean, someone like Wilt, there's the great channel I'm sure you know of, the Wilt Chamberlain archive, and it almost seems like there is more footage of Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell than there is of Dr. J and the ABA. It's pretty much about two games of his with New York and a couple of All-Star games. So we really are missing out on what supposedly and reportedly was just a bunch of great athletic feats from a guy who was the best player in the league and maybe might have been the best player in the NBA as well. At least he would have competed with Kareem and then Rick Barry and the other guys from that era.
Yeah, and it's in terms of you know whether he was the best or not, certainly the most the most exhilarating player of that time. And there are a lot of obviously great players who did exciting things and who were who captivated fans. But I don't think there's anything, at least from what I've heard, that compares to the way that Irving was able to bring in fans. Huey Brown talked about how the one thing about Irving was that he was able to, no one else in the ABA could turn your fans against you the way that he could by just, having a thrilling dunk on a fast break or pulling off some funky move that, no one had ever seen before. He was kind of a master at being able to, draw the crowd behind him and obviously give his team an advantage in those situations.
Oh yeah, that's the quote from him where he retold the stories of telling his players that if Julius is 20 feet from the basket and he's in the open court, just foul him, because if he pulls off some spectacular dunk, and he sure did pull off some spectacular dunks on Artis Gilmore from Kentucky, then the Kentucky crowd would turn against them, and it's a lost cause then.
Absolutely. So the beginning of how he got his name, there were a lot of claimed reasons during the time. He was the 1973 Complete Handbook of Pro Basketball. It says he's nicknamed the Doctor because of the way he operates on the floor. There are newspaper articles early on in his time in the Squires that refer to him as Dr. Irving instead of Dr. J. That obviously Dr. James was popularized later. When he was at Rucker Park, the commentators would call him the Claw or Black Moses, and Irving simply went over and said, "Look, if you're going to call me anything, just call me the Doctor." And the real reason, however, is that his friend in high school, he called him the Professor, and then eventually started to call Julius the Doctor, and that name stuck throughout his time in high school, and then at college at UMass, and then eventually as built his national name going into the ABA. And there were two doctors, there was a team doctor, of course, for the Virginia Squires. So the team trainer said, to avoid confusion, we're going to call you Dr. J. And that name eventually stuck with him. But it's interesting how, even the origins of how that Dr. J name was developed, even there were differences sort of in how that legend was told up until, he kind of clarified it more recently.
Yeah, the stories are different than many other. That's interesting to hear. Actually, I hadn't heard about it going back to his high school days, because as you said, in Loose Balls, Johnny Red Kerr credits center Willie Sojourner of the Squires. The film NBA TV did on Julius a couple of years back has Julius himself discussing nicknames through the process of playing at the Rucker. And as you said, him turning down such nicknames like the Claw, and I think something like Young Hawk, at least it was similar to a nickname of Connie Hawkins, something like that was also turned down.
Yeah.
Oh, Little Hawk, yeah. So yeah, the origins of his nickname have various backstories. I hadn't heard about this one. So yeah, that's a great find out.
Yeah. And, he was a relative unknown coming out of college. I mean, he played at a small university and hadn't really been on national TV. I mean, the idea of college games being on national TV was still a relatively new idea. But his legend initially grew out of playing at New York's Rucker Park, which was a league where a lot of the best pros of the time would play, and they would mix with a lot of streetball legends. Irving, his first time he played in Rucker Park was he had signed with the Squires but had yet to play in the NBA. So he was coming out of his junior year of college. He left early, and he teamed with his future teammates, Charlie Scott and Billy Paltz, also Hawthorne Wingo, who was a famous Rucker Park player and would compete against guys like Nate Archibald, Clyde Frazier, Earl Monroe, Willis Reed, Pee Wee Kirkland, a mix of guys with NBA credentials and with who were famous because of Rucker Park. And he talked about how he... playing at Rucker allowed him to really feel free for the first time. He felt like the chains were coming off. It's absurd to think about now, but he wasn't even allowed to dunk in college. And can you imagine his game without being able to dunk? And at this point, he is a more, he's a raw type player. He depends more on his rebounding, and his athleticism isn't much of a shooter yet. So he's really, a different style player to what he would become later as, the primary scorer on his team, and, in his ability to shoot the jumper, very important to his game. But at this point, it's much more raw. But he talks about this and also feeling the intense emotional connection with the record audience, and this kind of giving him a sense of the... adding to the artistic aspect of his game, and wanting to kind of push the boundaries of the type of moves that he could have, and the type of the way that he would interact with the crowd. The way that he put it, I start to get pretty freaky with my dunks, and learns to sort of give the crowd a show, although careful in these situations not to give them the whole show, to not, realizing that, of course, he's going to have to play professionally, and not to extend himself too much.
Yeah, what I love is that just everything about him is so 70s. You can't imagine a draft pick, even though he wasn't that well coveted. But a draft pick who has a contract with a professional team, going to play at the Rucker before his first pro year, and competing in these competitive games, and having other pros around there, and obviously the same applies to his college career. I think that in the 21st century, we would have highlights on him on various platforms like YouTube, and his potential would be more well known. But yeah, back then you don't make the recruiting services, and you don't get some 5-star rating, and you just sort of fly under the radar, and the people with the connections, the ones who scour for talent, they found at least some of them, but who knows, maybe there were other players who didn't make it to the pros just because it wasn't the AAU system wasn't that developed, and the coverage of college players wasn't that developed as well.
Yeah, and not to mention, of course, the still at a point where the opportunities for a lot of African American players are lessened, because of the kind of the hierarchy of the leagues, and even though that's changing by the late 60s, certainly that aspect of it is important. Just the it's harder for people with disadvantaged economic backgrounds to be in the league, and there's all part of that huge societal upheaval that's changing the landscape of the league. Certainly it's still evolving. This is also a time where the afro becomes a big part of his image. He does grow it out, and he it certainly attracts attention and attracts people to him. He talks about in his book, which I really recommend. It's a very good book. His autobiography. There's a very good audio book version of it as well, where he actually narrates it, which is a good way to consume it, I guess. And he talks about having to spend a half an hour some mornings to get it right, because the look is very important, and also sharing hair tips with Darnell Hillman, who was one of the few players who actually had a bigger afro than he did. So I guess they had lots to talk about as far as that goes. So
did we ever have I don't know, was it ever confirmed that Julius was also in the 77 award, competing at least for the award which Darnell Hillman won for the best afro in the from the former ABA players. I heard that a couple of episodes ago on this show.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, he would have had to be a contender. I mean, Artis obviously would be up there as well. Yeah, those are the three Afros that really stand out to me in the league. I mean, there were some other good ones, but those three are it's hard to top. That's your that's definitely your gold and silver and bronze for Afros in the ABA, I would have to say.
Yeah, and three good players also. Three great players. Yes. Well, obviously, Hillman's a category below, but three great players at that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's also first develops his friendship with Frazier during this time. He gets fitted with some fancy suits at Clyde's Tailor, and these are, he describes them as old Jewish and Italian guys with no signs on the door. And he basically gets the same... he does get the same types of suits as Frazier does, but he likes to have more conservative prints. He's not quite as colorful as Frazier is. And that sort of indicates to me, Irving's personality is interesting because it's a very much a mix of, he's very conservative in a lot of ways and very, doesn't like to make waves, isn't necessarily a guy who speaks out a lot or is a guy who, he doesn't necessarily demand the type of superstar treatment or attention that a lot of guys do, but yet he does have this incredible, you know, flair for his style of play, and does care very much about bringing the he wants to bring the playground style of game, but refined to the ABA and later the NBA. That does become very important to him. So I do think that mixture of that mixture of philosophies and styles, I think, is very interesting.
Not to jump ahead, as we'll get there and towards the end of the show, but the quote from Kevin Lockery in Loose Balls really reminded me of Tim Duncan and Greg Popovich, that someone as loud and demanding as Lockery could chew out everyone on his team, and that included Dr. J, and that he wouldn't mind it. So, yeah, in a way, he reminded me of Duncan, where he could face criticism, and he didn't mind being yelled at in front of the team. So that obviously had to help those New York Nets teams, which won two titles.
Yeah, and that takes a certain... I mean, it's hard if you have the power to not be yelled at, to not, you know, to not use that power. I mean, I do think no one likes to be yelled at, and you know, if you have the ability to... You know, if you're bigger than the coach, or you know, if you're the big superstar and you can avoid that, I think the fact that you know, Duncan and Irving are both secure enough as people to accept that, and accept that, you know, that allowing that enables your team to be better, that's a pretty special thing to have. You know, not a lot of people can do that in any kind of walk of life.
Yeah, and he, not to mention that he's bigger than the coach, he's bigger than the rest of the league, and he still takes it, so that's really admirable.
Yes, absolutely. So are there any, I've got a few here, but are there any of, you know, stories of, you know, spectacular dunks or other types of plays that stand out to you, whether it's from Loose Balls or anything else that you've that you've read or seen of you know, his ABA career?
The one which I don't think it was in Loose Balls, at least I read it on another place on the internet. It's this blog called, I might mess it up, I think it's 22ndtimeout.blogspot.com. It seems like this random little page, but you get the most awesome in-depth articles on there, specifically about the 70s and the 80s. And there's this story about the 72 NBA ABA All-Star game, the second of the Super Games. And unfortunately, the recording, which has survived until today, doesn't have the fourth quarter. And that's hardly convenient, given that that's the most important quarter in basketball. And supposedly, Julius took down a rebound, dribbled around whether it was Oscar Robertson or Charlie Scott or both of them, the counts vary. He certainly took on a couple of NBA guys and drove the length of the court and dunked nearby from at least somewhere near from the free throw line and slammed it down with this power that even the ABA guys who knew him at least from one season and the ABA, even they were astonished. But like I said, we have the recording of the game, and just as it's the story with everything from the ABA, we have the story, but not the actual footage. So that's the one I wish we could see, because the other three quarters are there, and it came in this important game for the ABA guys, because obviously they wanted to prove themselves and came up short both times.
There's a few that stand out to me. It's described, I don't know if it's the first preseason game or it's definitely the, you know, in his first season in the preseason, and he has a slam dunk over Artis Gilmore and Dan Issel, and Julius describes it as, you know, he's going up and up and up and sort of hanging there, and then as he sees the hand come down, it's over, and he has a big slam over Artis Gilmore. There's another one against the Pacers where he has a floating move, starts around Darnell Hillman, and then Mel Daniels comes over and he gets around him, and then Roger Brown tries to defend it, and it's sort of this, ends up almost under the basket, but he's able to spin the ball high off the glass under the basket, no look type of amazing type play. And Adolph Rupp, the legendary Kentucky coach, he Irving tells a story where he told him that he was the first player where he was okay with him making a decision after leaving his feet. It had been, you know, his philosophy his entire career to not tell players to do that, but he said, after watching you, I think I've changed my mind. So it was a rival coach or general manager, I forgot to write down who, but they were talking about accusations of the fact that Irving was, you know, walking as he was heading toward the basket, and then his reply was, "Yeah, he takes four steps in the air." So that's one of my favorite quotes as well. And then there's one last one with a George Irvine, who was his teammate on the Squires, and says he one time there was in warmups he was doing his thing where he'd throw the ball off the backboard, grab it with one hand, and dunk back over his head. It was a totally new dunk for him or anyone else. And Irvine said. "Doc, where'd you come up with that one?" And he said, "Last night I had a dream and I saw myself do it. I never tried it until today." And then Irvine was just like, he even makes up dunks in his dreams, you know, just, you know, incredulous at the idea that, you know, at the amazing skill that he had that, you know, seemingly came natural to him.
Yeah, that story is classic. And what I love about all of these accounts is that almost the guys from that era, mostly the coaches, they don't even have the words to describe the plays. It's you read a quote and at some points I just can't follow their way of thinking. I can't imagine, because it usually goes like that: Julius went up in the air, he flew by this one guy, he flew by this next guy, then he's somehow already under the rim, and he turned, and I think it really took everybody back, because they hadn't seen anything like that. So it's impossible for them to describe something they hadn't seen before, and we won't ever see how it happened because of the lack of footage.
So when he came to the Squires, the coach Al Bianchi and the general manager Red Kerr, neither had ever seen him in person before he signed. They had grainy footage from an NIT game, I think, against North Carolina, but other than that, they had not seen him before. So, and they gave him a, you know, pretty substantial contract to sign with the team. Basically, the Earl Foreman, the owner, had, you know, somebody mentioned it at a party, and then he talked to an assistant coach in Maine, near, you know, in the area where, near Massachusetts, where Irving was playing school. And then after hearing good things from him, took a photo of a magazine just to kind of get a sense, you know, looking at how he was rated. And that was basically the kind of scouting system that he, you know, that they had in 1971, especially in the ABA, operating on a shoestring. It's quite amazing that, you know, out of this, out of just all these, you know, having very little, they invest so much into him, and, you know, they see and that it works so amazingly well for them and for him in his career. And one thing that everyone points out when they first see him is the size of his hands, that, you know, his hands are so amazingly big that he, you know, can palm the ball in ways that no one else can, and you can hold it at angles that no one else can, because just of the size of his hands are able to give him this ball control that no one else actually has. And they describe his, I think it was Bianchi describing his fingers fingers is he has the fingers of a pianist or a surgeon. And then not long after his first tryout camp, Bianchi told journalists, "You're going to think I'm crazy, but one day Julius Erving will be in the Hall of Fame."
Yeah, and kudos to Earl Foreman, because he was the one in some of these stories who followed these connections and then took shots at guys who weren't well known, and it worked out for the best for Virginia, at least in the short term. And guess what? Yeah, both Julius and Gervin did become Hall of Famers as Al Bianchi thought that at least Julius would be.
So going on to the 72 Squires, they were a 45-win team with a .56 SRS. The year before, they'd actually been 55-29. It was Charlie Scott's rookie year where he was co-rookie of the year. Doug Moe also there toward the end of his career. Ray Scott, who was a pretty good big man from the NBA. And Jim Eakins, who would end up being a pretty solid big man for the Squires and later would join Dr. J on the Nets. Mostly a running team, not much of a defense. But at first, as we mentioned, he wasn't a finished product at all. His game was built on rebounding. Ray Scott actually helped him with his jump shot, gave him told him that the key was not to jump so high. And, you know, as long as you get it over, it doesn't matter if you jump 3 feet or 6 inches. You know, just the idea of getting to the same release point and to, you know, just get it over somebody that he felt that helped him develop a consistent jumper that made him into, you know, a great player. They traded George Carter, who had been an all-star that year, was a good player, to make room for him, immediately realizing, okay, this guy is going to be tremendous for us. They were sort of an up-and-down team for most of the year, and the big event that happened toward the end of the season with 9 games left is Charlie Scott was frustrated with the ABA. He abruptly left the team a few weeks before the end of the regular season. He was the leading scorer in the game at the time, jumped to Phoenix, a big loss for the ABA and particularly for the Squires. And there was never like a confrontation between the two of them, but this is sort of an interesting. It's one of several cases in Irving's career where he joins a team with an established star, and there's some tension over whose team, who's going to control the team, who's going to actually be in charge of the team. And, you know, Scott left the team at least in part because of, you know, having to, you know, being overshadowed by, you know, by Irving as a star and as a great player.
And it really was a crazy good and unexpected season from Charlie Scott during which he averaged 34.6 points per game. I'd even say that if someone asked you a trivial question about the guys who averaged more than 30 per season in the ABA, he's probably the only player you wouldn't get, with Rick Barry and Irving and Connie Hawkins and Dan Issel being more obvious choices. And with him bailing about 20 days before the playoffs and joining the Suns, probably that's what kept the Squires from going even farther than they did.
Yeah, and they swept the Floridians in the Eastern Division Series. The Floridians had Matt Calvin, Warren Jabali, and Larry Jones, some smaller guards. Of course, Jabali played bigger. Irving scored 53 points in the third game of the series and averaged 37.7 points per game and more than 20 rebounds per game. Incredibly, Irving was a really outstanding rebounder early on in his career. That's what sort of kind of go away as he got older and was probably asked to, you know, play away from the basket more. But his rookie season, he had 27.3 points per game and 15.7 rebounds per game, and would average double figures in rebounds all 5 years of his career in the ABA, and would, you know, average, you know, up until in 81, he averaged 8 rebounds per game, and then would be, you know, below 7 for the rest of his career as he would get older. But he was a especially great rebounder early on in his career, and was still pretty good skill up until his early 30s.
Yeah, I think it's a thing you would find with most small forwards, that rebounding is something that you do very well in your first years of the career, when you still have the bounce in your knees and you maybe play a bit more careless fashion. But 15.7 is something that you can't just explain with that. That's amazing, considering the fact that, yeah, as you mentioned, he was more so around 7 or 8 in the NBA, and probably pace has something to do with as well. I haven't looked at it, but I would think that the Squires of 72 played a bit faster than the Sixers would do in the 80s.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is the case. They were definitely known as a running team, so that would certainly make sense. So then they ended up playing the Nets in the Eastern Division Finals. Rick Barry had previously played with the Washington Capitals team that preceded the Squires. When they moved to Virginia, Barry did not want to go there and ended up forcing a trade to the Nets. The Nets also had John Roach, Billy Pultz, and Bill Melchione. Pultz and Melchione, well, actually, all three would be teammates with Irving soon in a couple years when Irving joined the Nets. This is notable. It's the only playoff series between Barry and Irving. Barry, he would leave for the NBA soon after this. The Nets had upset a 68-win Kentucky Colonels team, so giving the Squires home court advantage. And the Squires actually took a 2-0 lead in the series. They dominated Game 1, 138-91. And then the series was delayed for 9 days because there was issues with getting the Nets arena was booked, and they had issues with getting a replacement for it. So they did not. They ended up delaying it until Nassau Coliseum was available again. And that George Irvine and Doug Moe were hurt during that time. Bill Melchione, who had been hurt, got healthy, and that kind of changed things around. It did go to. So the Nets evened it up at 2 games apiece. Then they traded victories in games 5 and 6 to even things at 3-3. Irving, during one of these games, actually had 32 rebounds during this series. And then in game 7 in Virginia, he had 35 points, but the Nets were able to pull out the game 94-88. And Rick Barry banked in a 3-pointer near the end of the game to clinch it. So he... led the league in the playoffs with 33.3 points per game and 20.4 rebounds per game, both of which led the league in postseason play. George Irvine also shot very well during that time. He had a 66% field goal percentage. So for a rookie season, even though the Nets were a slightly worse regular season team, you would certainly take that as a pretty stout accomplishment, especially after they lost their leading scorer just a few weeks before the playoffs began.
Yeah, I tend to take these stories, but in particular, these are the players of their own team describing their own series of bad luck. I tend to take them with a grain of salt, but in this case, it really does seem like the 9-day layoff hurt them, because they won by 47 in the first game, a 9-point win in the second game, and it does seem like they might have squeezed past them even without Charlie Scott, but it probably was a year too early anyway, because I don't think they could have beaten the Indiana Pacers in the finals, who were in that midpoint of their veteran careers. Roger Brown and Mel Daniels is getting older, but they also have a George McGinnis able body, a young guy. So I don't think they would have stood a chance against them in the finals.
Yeah, and that would have. This was kind of one of two opportunities that I can think of the Nets and Pacers to be able to play in the finals. In this case the Squires, but either way, Irving's team to play against the Pacers in the finals, that never happened. Irving never played the Pacers in a playoff series. That would have been interesting to kind of see, the perennial team of most of the ABA versus their, the premier star, and we never had that. I guess we never would have been able to see it anyway, so I don't know how much we actually lost, but it's but it's interesting,
especially when Julius would have gone up against the George McGinnis if at least it happens before the 76 season, that when George was already in the NBA,
right?
But yeah, especially the year when they were co-MVPs, it would have made the most sense if they had the opportunity to play against each other, but So it never happened.
Yes, yes. So, so Earl Foreman, he will not renegotiate the Irving's contract, even though they agree that Irving, he deserves more money after, you know, establishing himself as a superstar. But Irving does say, I don't plan to spend the rest of my career with Virginia, so he won't renegotiate the deal. Irving's also frustrated with his first agent, who he felt was working with the ABA at the same time as representing him, which was definitely was an issue. There were agents that were double dipping, so to speak. Early on, that was a complaint that, you know, people in the ABA and the NBA both had about agents. So Irving eventually decides to sign with the Atlanta Hawks, agrees to a 5-year, $1.5 million contract. There are lawsuits, of course, going on during this time. The Squires sue, saying they have a valid contract. Also, during this time, the Milwaukee Bucks draft Irving. The NBA still was not drafting underclassmen at this point, but he would have been a senior had he stayed in college, so he was eligible for the NBA draft. And the Bucks had 2 first-round picks, so they decided we'll go ahead and draft him. Wayne Embry had, who was Bucks general manager, he had experience with Irving, actually played him in a pickup game as a high schooler, in which Irving almost destroyed him with Embry being an NBA player with the Celtics during that time. So he knew him. They decided, you know, we'll take the chance, and we have 2 first round picks, so we might as well just use one on him. However, Irving doesn't think that being the number 3 star on the Bucks behind Kareem and Oscar Robertson is a very good idea, so he decides to play with the Hawks, and he ends up actually playing a couple of exhibition games with the Hawks, and really speaks highly about playing with Pete Maravich, really impressed with his strength and his size and his speed, and learns a lot about fast break basketball during the time in which they play together. They play a lot of one-on-one games together, and they really feel like they match each other move for move. And of course, you know, one of the great what ifs in basketball history, especially if you're a Hawks fan, is, which I am, wondering what, you know, if Irving had jumped to the NBA, this and having him and Maravich together along with Lou Hudson and Walt Bellamy, who was still a pretty strong big man even though he was aging at this point, how that would have changed the course of a basketball history. It wouldn't have been good for the ABA. It may not have been good for Irving, but it certainly is a interesting imagination exercise to wonder, you know, how that combination, you know, particularly Maravich and Irving, would have been during that time.
Then it might have saved Pete Maravich's career as well. Not obviously the team would have been better, but given how Maravich's mood was affected by not getting along with other players and not playing winning basketball, I mean, having someone like Julius Irving running the wing for him, and he's the perfect target for all of the passes he could have thrown. It might have played a positive influence on Maravich's career, and who knows, maybe his life and development as well.
Yeah. And he played in 2 exhibition games against ABA opponents, ironically. He never actually played an exhibition game against an NBA team. It was the Colonels and the Cougars. Eventually, the courts ruled that he had to honor his prior contract with the Squires, and also the NBA office ruled in favor of the Bucks. So at this point, they were being, I believe they're being fined $25,000 a game. So the Hawks decided to give up, and a federal judge issues an injunction prohibiting Irving from playing for any of the team other than Virginia. So he goes back to the Squires. The case is technically thrown into arbitration, and it'll be resolved after he plays the 73 season with the Squires. When he joins, they're 0-4 when he starts. He feels like they don't quite have the same chemistry. They lose Mo and Ray Scott, who were, you know, their key veterans at this point, mostly a young team. They're 42-42 with a negative .29 SRS. He does mention that there were not really hard feelings with Earl Foreman. You know, both of them just thought it was just business, and he even lived at his house during the second season with Foreman. He was usually away, not living at the house, so that he and his wife shared. He actually lived there for rent-free while during his second season. So I guess Earl Foreman was a forgiving guy.
Yeah, and same goes for Julius. I mean, is there even anything bad you can say about his ABA stint? Everyone seems to love the guy, respect the guy, and he almost did no wrong.
So this is notable for George Gervin joining the team late. He was thrown off of his Eastern Michigan team for fighting, but he ended up being another Squires at Discovery. I believe Red Kerr also through a through former Syracuse Nationals teammate George King discovered him, and they end up playing together for 28 games toward the end of the season. Also, Irving describes their one-on-one games during the season as well. So you guys have played one-on-one games against Pete Maravich and George Gervin all within the same calendar year or so. They would lose to the Colonels 4-1 in the division semifinals. The Colonels with Artis Gilmore, Dan Issel, and Louis Dampier having were a much better regular season team during that time. With the Colonels will make the finals and lose to the Pacers during that time. So
Gervin and Irving on the same team is the obvious thing. When you look back at it, the minutes they might have played together were probably the most unusual thing back then. They are like two unicorns. Here you have this 6'7" rail thin wing in Gervin, who possesses uncanny scoring and just movement abilities for a player of his height, and obviously Irving, who's the most athletic player on the planet, probably. I mean, that was so ahead of its time that it's unbelievable that they got the opportunity to play on the same team. I mean, they would be a wing duet of Gervin and Irving could probably play today. And they would still be something to I don't know, appreciate very highly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I that would be, of course, a fascinating thing to see. You were lamenting, of course, a lot of things that we didn't get a chance to see, but that would be tremendous as well.
Surely about Johnny Kerr, have you ever read the Harry Potter books? There's this one thing they had that a person was able to store his memories in that basin, and if he had one, it seems like Johnny Red Kerr was the person who should have one. I mean, that guy saw Michael Jordan his whole career. He played with a young Will Chamberlain, and he saw Julius in the ABA and also Gervin as well. I think he has the things we're most not deprived of by not having much footage of. So yeah, he was a lucky man if you consider the things he saw and what he experienced.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, I knew those things individually, but I hadn't quite put them together until you mentioned that. So that's a fascinating thing to think about. So he is traded to the Nets. Roy Bowe, the Nets owner, wants a replacement for Rick Barry, who has left for the NBA, as we mentioned. Virginia has financial issues at this point. He ends up agreeing to go to the team after negotiating with Bowe. There's a big settlement involving the Squires and Hawks and Bucks, and all of them get various money and draft picks and things to get it settled. The official trade between the Nets and the Squires is Irving and Willie Sojourner, who he was rookie with on the Squires. They end up at the Nets for George Carter, who had been traded away originally from the Squires to the Nets to make room for Irving. So the irony there, and also the rights of Kermit Washington, who never played in the ABA, and $1 million. And then Irving signs a big contract with the Nets that the Squires could never have afforded, although it turns out the Nets actually struggled to pay it too. But we'll get to that a little bit later. And this sort of shows sort of the issues with the regional franchise idea in general. I talked about that with Rich in a previous show, but basically Virginia would have to sell off all their stars, you know, Barry, Irving, and later Sven Nader and George Gervin, and the team would really be terrible in the ABA's final seasons, barely hanging on before folding a month before the merger, which is unfortunate because the Squires definitely had they had some very good times, and they had some very good players and teams, and you know, could have potentially, you know, things had turned just a little bit, you know, could have won a championship, or, you know, certainly made a finals and been, you know, more embedded. Even if they didn't survive the merger, they still could have been embedded more in the memory, other than just being this team that, you know, all these great players began at and then, you know, never and then didn't last.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that they didn't have one of the owners who was willing to spend money at least for a couple of years. And in the meantime, it was really fortunate for the ABA that they had an owner like Roy Bowe at the time, who could pay $1 million for Julius, because they were, in a way, they were bidding against the NBA. And if this summer had happened at the wrong time, during which most of the owners are scrambling for money, they could have lost him just because of that. Although I guess Angelo Drossos and the Spurs might have been crazy enough to keep spending. So maybe the Spurs would be the ones who might have stayed with the league. But other than Roy Boo, I'm not certain whether there is another team who would have had the money to take on Julius in the summer of 73. So it might have saved the ABA and kept them living for another 3 years.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And yeah, the ownership in general, I mean, I would imagine maybe John White Brown, it's a possibility because he had some deep pockets, although it wasn't, you know, was and spent them to a degree for a while until, you know, the team started to lose money. But yeah, I would imagine that you're right, that Bo was definitely the one team that had that chance. It was also important for, I mean, everyone agreed that it was important for Irving to stay in the league. Because at this point, you know, even by this point, it was obvious that he was the most important player. And the fact that he was coming home, he had grown up in Long Island and played you know in that area, and so the fact that he was coming home would also potentially bring some attention to the league as, you know, being the hometown star. It didn't quite work out as well as they were hoping for, although obviously he did bring the team some attention. Reynis and I went a bit long in our conversation, so we decided to split it into two parts. So check out our next episode for discussion on Dr. J's championship years with the New York Knicks in the last days of the ABA. Also, check out Reynis' The Handle podcast and his Lamar Maddock Twitter account and YouTube channel. You can find us at harvardparoxysm.com and on iTunes and Stitcher. We would greatly appreciate a review if you are enjoying our podcast. And also, we are on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.